Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a great pleasure for me to open the sessions on the atomic clocks today, and I would really like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this workshop, and I hope we will have some very nice discussions this week. So this is the outline of my talk. I will start with giving a few of the quantitative specifications of atomic clocks. I think this is important if we discuss possible tests to understand what clocks really can do and where they have improved. What has largely improved over the last years are the optical clocks, and I will point out where the progress has been. There's actually now a number of very precise systems that have made very good progress recently. I will, since we have more speakers today covering different systems, I will focus here on, on the trapped ion clocks, giving examples also from our laboratory in Braunschweig. And as far as tests are concerned, I will give an update on limits on variations that have been obtained with different clocks, also including some new data. And if time allows, I will speak about this nuclear clock system. It's something that promises very high sensitivity, very high precision, a really new system and very promising system in the field. So here the general scheme of an atomic clock looks like this. There is an oscillator producing an electromagnetic wave. This wave is used to probe some atomic molecular resonance. That is the actual reference of the clock. A detector detects the spectroscopic signal. There is some resonance feature, and this feature is used to steer the oscillator to the atomic resonance frequency. That is the actual frequency determining element in this frequency standard. And this would describe a frequency standard. And in order to have a clock, one needs a device for counting these oscillations or for producing standard frequencies. This is a clockwork. In the optical case, it is a femtosecond laser frequency comb generator. And then from this, we can get a time reading. So this is a generic feature of the clock. And now there are, of course, very many technical variants to this. And that's why I first want to point out a little bit the general characteristics in terms of specifications of the clock. So there's always excitement if somebody announces a new clock and then it's for the general press and then they make a big article saying it's the best clock. But what is the best clock? What is the best car? Is it a Ferrari or rather is it a thing where you can transport 10 people? So there are different criteria. And the same for clocks, there are different quantitative specifications. So an important one is the accuracy, and it means going back to this atomic reference, how well does the clock frequency, the output frequency, actually agree with the unperturbed atomic transition frequency that is supposed to be investigated under some idealized conditions that would not shift the transition frequencies, like having the absorbers at V equals zero, having absence of external electric and magnetic fields that may shift the frequencies. And this is, of course, based on the postulate that we have the atomic frequencies as a universal natural constant that would obey the equivalence principle and that would be universal and fixed. And this accuracy is quantified in a systematic uncertainty that's usually the result of an uncertainty evaluation, taking all kinds of frequency shifting effects into account. And I will just give you numbers here, not giving the details of the uncertainty budget. So important clocks, the cesium clocks that realize the SI definition of the unit of time, the second, and they presently have the best ones, have systematic uncertainties in the low 10 to the minus 16. And the most advanced optical clocks that we will hear about today now have surpassed this by more than one order of magnitude, nearly two orders of magnitude. So presently we have a number of optical clocks that now reach uncertainties in the 10 to the minus 18 range. And what's very interesting is we have now, we are starting to build up a variety of really different systems. Presently, I think the count is five clocks that have been evaluated with an uncertainty below 10 to the minus 17. I should point out, however, that these cannot be measured directly to measure time. Time is measured by the cesium clock, but they can, of course, be used for frequency ratio measurements for doing relative measurements at this lower uncertainty. Now, well, this is the yes. So this could be, this is really the systematic uncertainty, the systematic uncertainty to which you can give frequencies or times. And I would also like to point out, and it's important also for tests, that the concepts I will speak about today, about these clocks and also the SI definition of time, refers really to proper time. The proper time measured with a local clock, it means that relativistic contributions usually are not part of the uncertainty budget, except for parts related to the motion of the atoms, but that otherwise for non-local clock comparisons, of course, they are very important, and they are of course important to apply it in time scales like terrestrial times, time scales TAI and UTC. So accuracy, the one important criterion. The other important criterion is stability. This is a statistical quantity, and saying to what kind of averaging time do we need in order to obtain a certain statistical uncertainty in the frequency or time measurement. And this is practically very important. It is, of course, also very important in designing tests. It is quantified in the clock business by a so-called Allen deviation. It is a two-sample deviation variance of consecutive frequency measurements. And of course, it is practically very important, because speaking about accuracy first, the systematic uncertainty you reach in order to verify this and to use this, you have to get the statistical uncertainty below the systematic uncertainty, and it takes averaging time, and the stability basically tells you how long you need to average. And I will give you here, without derivation, a generic expression for how this stability improves for an optimized clock, limited in the noise here with the quantum projection noise. It is with the quantum noise in the reading of the state of the of these atoms defining the frequency. And in this case, the instability scale is like the inverse of the line Q, that is the ratio of the reference frequency and the line widths. And then these clocks are all interrogated in a cyclic fashion. Atoms are prepared, for example, by laser cooling. Some state preparation is needed, and then they are interrogated. And so the number of measurements also counts then, and this is basically this ratio here of the cycle time for one measurement divided by the total averaging time, and also with 1 over the square root enters the atomic number determining via the quantum projection noise. And so this, apart from some numerical factors of order unity, is a very general applicable relation for good atomic clocks. And if you put in some numbers, for example, the type of clocks I'm going to talk about relying on single ion, single trapped ion, so the N is just one. The frequency is in the optical range, 10 to the 15 hertz, line width 1 hertz in 1 second obtained. So this factor here is 10 to the minus 15. And then we get, for this uncertainty, 10 to the minus 15 over square root of tau expressed in seconds. So it means we can get a 15-digit reading in 1 second. But if you want to get to the 10 to the minus 18 that I said are possible in principle, it takes 3 orders of magnitude improvement here. It means we need to average for like 10 to the 6 seconds or a few days, or maybe 10 days. But still, this is really very good, or it's state of the art, close to the state of the art instability. If you look at cesium clocks, the most precise cesium clocks, the line Q here is in the microwave range. It's smaller, it's 10 to the minus 10. But this is partly compensated by the much bigger number of atoms. About 1 million atoms are launched and interrogated each second. And then we have to 10 to the minus 13 instability in 1 second. But again, we arrive at the same averaging time. So the instability, the accuracy of the best cesium clocks is now in the 10 to the minus 16 range, also requiring 3 orders of averaging, 10 to the 6 seconds, a few days in order to arrive at this low statistical uncertainty. Okay, here you can see the graph showing the rapid progress in the field. Now this is the fractional uncertainty, the accuracy again, plotted for the development of atomic clocks over the recent decades. Well, the cesium clock, these light blue points here, has been introduced in the 1950s. And it followed like a Moore's law, that is, it improved in accuracy by about one order of magnitude per decade, and has now reached the 10 to the minus 16 range. And then the optical frequency standards progress started later, but was much more rapid. And you can see that around 1990 here, the best optical standards were about four orders of magnitude, lower accuracy than the cesium clocks. And now the best ones have surpassed cesium uncertainties by nearly two orders of magnitude already. And I will speak about some points here in this lower part of the diagram. The color change here is to indicate the change between frequency measurements uncertainties relative to cesium. And since the point where the uncertainty of the optical clocks are reproducible is better than cesium, we can no longer do frequency measurement, but this is a result of these uncertainty evaluations of optical standards. There is two physical systems that are mainly investigated for these high-precision optical clocks, and we will hear about both of these systems today. They always rely on laser-cooled and trapped atoms. The atoms need to be localized, and the kinetic energy needs to be reduced. The trapping for neutral atoms can be done most efficiently by holding the atoms in an interferometric pattern of light-induced dipole traps. So this is a so-called optical lattice clocks, and they work via the dipole force induced by the light field on the atoms. And we will have two talks, I think, today, first by Hidetoshi Katori on this type of lattice clock. The other clock that I will speak more about and that my group is active in is the one with ion traps. So this is charged particles held in electromagnetic fields. These traps are very stable, very deep. And they can trap particles with minimal perturbation of the trap on the energy level structure. That's very good for the atomic clock. But the disadvantage is that in this case, the number of particles is much smaller. Basically, the precision experiments are mainly done with a single particle, which gives good control of the systematics, but low signal to noise and relatively smaller stability and statistical accuracy. Okay, I will go a little bit more into detail into these trapped ion clocks. So here is the main ideas together with a gallery of Nobel Prize winners that have made seminal ideas in this field. I should mention Hans Demelt, which in the 1970s pointed out this opportunity of using very narrow forbidden transitions in trapped particles as references of atomic clocks, proposing the use of the Paul trap and proposing laser cooling together with Dave Wineland, who was a postdoc in Demelt's group at that time. And now, recently, Dave Wineland won the Nobel Prize for the application of the quantum logic scheme, which turned out to be a very successful scheme in the optical clocks with trapped ions. So here just some pictures. I showed you this already. Typical ion trap on with a millimeter size, confining the particle with electric fields. Then this is combined with laser cooling to reduce the kinetic energy. The aim is here to reach the so-called Landicke regime, where the oscillation amplitude of the ion in the trap is smaller than the wavelengths of the radiation that is used to probe the particle. And in this case, this eliminates the linear Doppler effect, which is the basic requirement for a precise clock. Then the state readout is done by looking at quantum jumps in a double resonance experiment. So a fast transition is driven to observe fluorescence. You can see fluorescence from individual trapped ions. And then each time a metastable state on a narrow transition is excited, one sees a dark period. And in counting these events, one can then set up very narrow spectral lines, like here, an example of a forbidden transition that is driven about once per second and showing a 2 hertz line width optical spectrum, so a line Q of about 10 to the 14. Very different types of transitions are investigated in this field as the reference transitions, and this is also something that is interesting and important. These different transitions are being investigated because it is not clear which one will be the optimum, if there isn't an optimum for the practical clock. But it's also interesting because now we have different atomic systems that have different sensitivities to underlying fundamental parameters, to coupling constants. And so this actually is an important feature in allowing these fundamental tests. So for example, there is transitions between levels with vanishing electronic angular momentum in two electron systems. And these are induced just by the interaction with the nuclear spin, so they are hyperfine quenched. Prominent example, the aluminum plus that is studied at NIST in Boulder, is the quantum logic operated clock. And the advantage of this type of transition is that they have very small field-induced systematic shifts. Then these classes of atoms here, these are single electron, alkali-like systems. And they have been used or selected mainly for technical convenience. They have wavelengths, transition wavelengths that are more easily accessible for available laser systems. And there is then a higher order multipole transitions like electroquadrupole transitions or even an octopole transition in the ytterbium here, about which I will speak a little bit more today. This transition, of course, has a very narrow line width, and it's interesting as a test case for changes of the fine structure constant. And I will also point out this very special system from nuclear physics, where there is a low energy transition, a magnetic dipole in this thorium 229 nucleus.
Which, I think, how close is it to a nuclear clock?
I will come to it towards the end of my talk. Okay. Until now, there's a way to go towards a nuclear clock, definitely. We still need to see the transition, but
to measure the energy.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. still some way to go. I will come to the ytterbium system that is studied in PDB. Mm-hmm. Some of the features are really generic for the single ions clocks. Some are specific for the ytterbium here. You see the level scheme here. Okay, it looks a bit complicated, but it is not so much. It is, in fact, a sodium-like, you can say, single electron feature. So there is an S to P resonance line that is used for laser cooling and the fluorescence detection. But then, unlike sodium or rubidium, there is lower lying states of higher angular momenta. So these states cannot decay to the ground state via emission of dipole radiation. So we have here narrow reference transitions, first a quadrupole line S to D, and then this octopole line S to F. We are working with an isotope 171, which nuclear spin 1/2, and this has an important advantage because then this nuclear and electronic spin couple to integer angular momentum, and specifically we have an F equals 0 ground state that is just a single level without linear Zeeman shift, so it's very easy to prepare the atom in this state, and then it doesn't have a linear field dependence. So this is the lower level of the reference transitions, and then we are always driving MF0 to 0 components on these two transitions. The quadrupole transition was first studied at PDB for quite some time already. It is formally also now regarded as a secondary representation of the second. The natural line width here is on the order of 3 hertz, and this is actually something that is in reach today with stable laser sources. And the systematic uncertainty we have obtained was about 1 × 10⁻⁶. But recently we focused on this octopole transition S to F. The pioneering work on this transition has been done at the British NPL. They were the first to do laser excitation of this highly forbidden line. The lifetime of the excited state is estimated to be several years, like 6 to 8 years. So the natural line width we are dealing here with is in the nanohertz range. Of course, we will not do experiments on this scale. It means that the resolution, spectral resolution, will always only be limited by the available laser sources. But it means, so if we have progress in lasers, we can directly benefit from it on this transition. But what it's really nice about this is that it has very small systematic shifts through external fields. It's a bit counterintuitive at looking at this level scheme, but I will explain a little bit why this is so. So this is the interest of this. there is a drawback that this line being so narrow, it means a little bit more laser intensity is needed to drive it. And now this somewhat stronger laser, of course, non-resonantly also couples to other transitions, and this leads to a light shift of this transition, which is then a function of the laser intensity, and this produces a systematic shift in the uncertainty. But we have recently understood how to deal with this shift and how really to eliminate it very, very efficiently.
It probably depends on the intensity.
Yes. Exactly. That's one way to do it, to work at different intensities and then to extrapolate it back. But there was an even more more efficient way to deal with it.
For us here, is how we sort of see the transition that the decay back is so long.
Yeah. No, you see, well, we could, of course, you know, we cannot wait for the decay. Now, in our case, in the trap, the at ultra high vacuum, the decay is probably still limited by collisions, but maybe on the vessel lifetime on the order of 1 hour or so. But of course, well, the same laser that drives it can stimulate the transition back. That would be one way. But what we do practically is actually we pump it back via an additional repumper laser. Everything is also done on now on the with the Hertz resolution scale. So on a 1 second cycle, we detect the excitations and decays of this state. Here you are. Maybe I should show this graph first. Here you can see how the spectrum looks like. So the ion is prepared, laser cooled, pumped into the initial state, and then a pulse of variable duration is applied for this narrow transition. Here we use pulses of 300 milliseconds and 50 microwatt power. You see, it's not that we are talking megawatt scale or so. It is, but of course, it's related. It is, if we have a laser that has a 1 hertz line width, then we have this 50 microwatt power. And then you can get this really very nice. So the red curve is what you would expect in the textbook from driving a two-level system, Fourier limited with rectangular pulses. And you can see that we can really get to this quality in the experiment quite nicely. But under these conditions, you can see 2 hertz line width, very nice, but the light shift here for these conditions is 4 hertz. So the line is displaced by more than its width. And this is, of course, something that is completely intolerable for any precise clock.
So when you expect a signal, I understand that there is fluctuation, but there is a point there where the expected function goes to zero, and how can it be non-zero signal there? It means that some background.
It is. I cannot tell you with certainty what happened there. No, I think there's very little background, I think it's either fluctuations of the Rabi frequency or fluctuations of the laser frequency. I think it's mainly fluctuations of the laser frequency.
Like
it's like taking such a spectrum takes like 1 minute or so. And so we are in the regime where we have 1/f noise in the laser reference cavity influencing, and I think it is excursions of the laser frequency that lead to this defect. Of course, you can say, why do not we have similar deviations at top?
No, but they are used by signals, so it's
yeah. No, it's not perfect. It is laser noise. Again, I think that's the main. I wanted to say, why is this octopole transition a good transition, a good reference for the clock? You can see it here if you look at the single electron configurations. So the ground state here is a filled F shell, and then there's a single 6s electron that is dominant valence electron for the properties of the spectrum. The quadrupole line S to D is really exciting this valence electron from the 6s to the 5d. But the octopole line is different, so it creates a hole in the filled F shell, leaving a 4F13, and then promoting this F electron to the 6S, filling the 6S shell. And so now we have a spherically symmetric 6S shell surrounding this hole in the F shell. And you can see, looking at the charge radii here, that the F shell is really inside the 6S. And this intuitively explained why this state here is less polarizable, has a smaller quadrupole moment than the D state, and this is one of the advantages for the use in the clock in terms of systematic frequency shifts. Okay, I would tell a little bit about the uncertainty budget without going into the details. You can see just here, look at this as a typical work of a clock developing group, one really needs to look at all kinds of different field-induced shifts, motional shifts. Here is the uncertainty budget we made for the octopole transition in 2012, and you can see there was two dominant contributions to the uncertainty. The one was this light shift extrapolation method. We did exactly what you proposed, that it worked. It resulted in a 4 parts 10⁻⁷ uncertainty. And this we eliminated with, I'm not going into the details, but please look up this reference. We used a modified Ramsey excitation scheme with 3 pulses, where the light shift induced by the laser is compensated, and this eliminated this uncertainty contribution here. It is a little bit like what NMR people do with echo pulses. So since the problem here is induced by the excitation itself, by the interrogation itself, we can also control it in a way. And the clever proposal here by Valery Yudin and Alexei Taichinachev was to find a scheme where this compensation of the light shift can be done in a way that is not sensitive to small errors that one does in the compensation scheme, and this works very effectively, detailed in this paper. And the other thing that bothered us and that bothers most of presently all atomic clocks is AC star shift from blackbody radiation. So the clock is operating at room temperature, and it means the ion is exposed to the blackbody radiation from the thermal environment, from the trap, from the vacuum chamber, and we want to control this, or we want to exactly control the shift it induces. So basically, the underlying idea is that we don't want to measure a frequency at room temperature, but we want to measure at T equals zero. Otherwise, one would mix time measurement with temperature measurement and so on. So this should just be avoided. But it means that we have uncertainties here related either to the uncertainty in the blackbody field. So we need to know the temperature quite precisely, and also the temperature distribution. And we also need to know the shift coefficient, that is how this thermal field influences, how much does it shift the line. And you can see here that at this point, actually, the shift was about estimated to be 1 part 10⁻⁶, and the uncertainty was about 50% of the shift, and this was simply because we didn't know the shift coefficient well enough. Of course, that's of course the best way experimentally to handle it, to work at cryogenic temperature. But what we did, we continued to work at room temperature, and here just some pictures of the analysis that one has to do. So this is our ion trap, actually a dummy model. If there is high voltages here applied, then like 1,000 volt or so, alternating field. There is some ceramics here that do the insulation, and there is electric field that heats these ceramics. And you can see here in an infrared picture that the ceramic part here emits infrared radiation, and you have an inhomogeneous field of blackbody of thermal radiation. And so we, in cooperation with a group at CMI in Prague, they did full thermal analysis of our trap systems. And so we got the decisive parameters now much more precisely. We can estimate that the effective temperature seen by the ion is elevated over temperature of the chamber by 2 degrees Kelvin with an uncertainty of 1. And the other important thing is now we know the shift coefficients here much more precisely. And so, in summary, we have succeeded in over the last 2 years in eliminating these two dominant systematic uncertainty contributions. You can see now from an unpublished, very recent PhD thesis, the present uncertainty budget for both the ytterbium transitions, for the quadrupole and for the octopole. And you can see it's nice to compare it. And that's also something that's very interesting. We have the two transitions in one ion trapped in the same trap. So we can also use one transition as a kind of diagnosis where the shifts are bigger in order to quantify the external perturbations and then use it to correct the smaller influence on the higher precision octopole transition. And you can see, for example, here this quadrupole shift induced by frequency gradients is like a factor of 50 or so smaller. The thermal shift also is smaller on the E3 transition. And so summing up the present state of the art for the octopole transition, we arrive at 3.9 parts in 10 to the minus 18, and it is an evaluated uncertainty budget, but I think as today, as I'm speaking, it is the most precise evaluated uncertainty budget of an atomic clock. But as I mentioned, progress has been very rapid in this field. So I think we are going to see more results.
So could I ask a question? So the second order Doppler, this is the micro motion, right? Is it the
Yes, well, this is related to micro motion, also to thermal motion. We are not cooling to the quantum ground state. And also we need to worry about heating of the ions during the interrogation. So during the interrogation, we are not cooling the ion anymore. So it starts to heat up by interaction with fluctuating electric fields, and all this comes together.
The projected, ultimate limit that you would get, you will freeze out black body, right? But the second order Doppler, by how much can it be reduced?
This is close to, I think, what we can do with the present laser cooling and detection of motion methods. It will not become much better. We are profiting already from the fact that we have a very heavy particle. In order to go further here, we would need better cooling to start with, and then we need better control of the heating. So it may also mean that eventually we may have to use maybe cryogenic apparatus to avoid these fluctuating electric fields and that heat it up. Well, of course, we could ultimately go to the quantum ground state and then correct for this shift. But here, typically, we start in the tens oscillator state, and then it heats up to the 100, 500 or so oscillator quantum number.
So the ultimate projected limit is 10 to the minus 18, or you could do better than 10 to the minus 18?
Well, I think there will, even if you go to the quantum ground state, we will have a shift of maybe 1 in 10 to the minus 18, but a shift, okay, so the uncertainty can be smaller. The uncertainty finally may be smaller, but it's not so much room there. You are to improve this.
Could you operate this clock at the same both traditions at the same time?
Not at the same time. We should not, of course, not apply two radiations at different wavelengths at the same time.
Well, not exactly but the different shots.
In an interleaved way, exactly. Yeah, that's actually what we do. So most of the experiments that we did for investigating these systematics were done with just a single system, and then we were changing parameters in an interleaved matter. And
so what would be the alternative ratio of those two frequencies?
That will be the next interesting experiment to do to directly measure the optical frequency ratio. That would be the very interesting test also for variations of constants. Yeah. Okay, this is the status in terms of the uncertainty for the ytterbium, and I would now like to come to the tests we could do it, and the one interesting one we can do with the ytterbium is look for variations of constants, and I will focus here on alpha and mu, the proton-electron mass ratio, the two most important dimensionless number maybe, and actually the ytterbium can contribute something to this field. Why is it? Again, I'm showing this picture here on the single electron configurations, and because these two states are so different, the highly excited electron, the higher excited electron, and the hole state here, and also because ytterbium is so heavy, high nuclear charge, strong relativistic contributions, the relativistic contributions to the level energies are big, and they are quite different in the D and in the F state. There is a change of sign, so this is a sensitivity factor from atomic structure calculations, and it indicates that both transitions show high sensitivity to change of alpha, and also with different sign, based on these calculations here by Duba, Flambaum, and colleagues. And so, as was just discussed, it will be very interesting to compare these two transitions. What we did, so what we have done over the time was mainly comparisons, not directly between the two lines, but over with cesium clocks. And we have in our laboratory right next, on the next optical table, there is the next setup for the cesium fountains. And as I mentioned, the quadrupole transition already was started and precision measurements were done in 2000 already. So we have quite some record over time for in blue here for the quadrupole line, and now more recently and more precisely also for the octopole line. Mm-hmm. You can see the improvement here. It seemed to converge, but it's actually not what you see here. It's not so much the improvement in the optical clock, but it's the improvement in the cesium clock. So the final final points are now completely limited by the cesium uncertainty. But you can see here we can measure, okay, to 15, somewhat better than 15 digits, these two frequencies. Now, what can we learn in terms of variations of constants from these comparisons to cesium? So I've listed here the data available from precise absolute frequency measurement, that is comparisons of optical gross structure to cesium hyperfine frequencies. And there is now, there have been more measurements, but these are the four most precisely, that is the lowest uncertainty in the frequency ratio drift, that are available. Two from the ytterbium, one from the strontium lattice clock, about which we will hear more in the talk by Hidetoshi Katori later. Gross structure? Electronic structure. Electronic transitions.
Not fine.
Okay. back what's the nomenclature? Okay. And so we are measuring here ratio of an electronic gross structure to hyperfine structure transition. And in order to analyze in terms of fundamental constants, we are using here a very simple model, as was introduced by Flambaum, by Karschenbaum, has been used quite for some time in the literature. So the electronic transition, the gross structure transition, just written as a product of the non-relativistic part, this constant here containing the atomic structure, the Rydberg frequency, plus the relativistic corrections to the level energy. For hyperfine structure, the same parts, an additional alpha square for the hyperfine term, and a term from nuclear structure for the nuclear magnetic moment of the cesium. And now, the cesium, if you allow for temporal variations in this frequency ratio, there will be a sum of three terms, all the terms related to alpha. And depending on this, on the difference of the sensitivity factors for the electronic transition, for the hyperfine transition, the dependence on proton electron mass comes here from the nuclear magnetic moments. And then there is another distribution from the quark masses also for the nuclear structure. This part, fortunately, for cesium-based measurements is very small. So it makes a very small contribution to this analysis. And I'm using actually an experimental limit that was taken from comparison of two hyperfine frequencies in rubidium and in cesium. This reference here from the French team in Paris, and this also shows the result of a 2012 analysis of the available frequency measurement and drift rate that were available at the time, together with the sensitivity vectors that have been used. Of course, there was frequency measurements, the dysprosium experiment that we have heard about already, and the most prominently for the change of alpha dominant limitation from the aluminum to mercury frequency ratio measured in Dave Weinland's group at ETNIS. And now we see with the more recent data from ytterbium, we have some more opportunities for analyzing it. So this is first the data measured with absolute frequencies with cesium clocks. Going back to this expression here, we can now, all this is the same, everything's measured relative to cesium. And now we just do a linear regression of the drift rate versus the sensitivity for the different atomic systems that are studied. And then we see the change in alpha as a slope of this line. As you can see it here, the present status. The two ytterbium transitions having the biggest difference in the sensitivity factors And then with similar uncertainty, the experiment from the mercury and strontium absolute frequency measurements. Here is the constraints derived here, about 6 parts 10^-17 per year for alpha, and about 2 parts 10^-16 per year for relative change of mu. So this is a slight improvement in the laboratory limit for mu. But if you now take everything together, all the available precision data, the diagram looks like this. We saw an earlier version of this diagram today. So this is the updated version. It looks a bit messy, I'm afraid. So the vertical lines here are the alpha constraining experiments, aluminum over mercury frequency ratio, the dysprosium experiment, and then the cesium based measurements go here under some slope. The width of these lines reflects the uncertainty in the frequency ratio measurement. And you can see that taken together now, especially the ytterbium data here help to constrain this ellipse now also in the d mu over dt direction. And it is an agreement also somewhat pushing a little bit the mercury and the strontium result. So this is the uncertainty ellipse we get here, and from this we get the alpha limitation, okay, mainly determined by the aluminum mercury experiment, but we get an improvement in the proton to electron mass ratio by about a factor of 2, 1.6 parts 10^-16 per year now. It's presently the most stringent laboratory limit, and of course consistent with the constancy of the constant in the present epoch. So this picture will develop further. Also, accuracy of these measurements is going to improve. But you can see that these different experiments now, I think, in a diagram like this, start to make meaningful contributions to this type of analysis. Okay, I'm going to come to the thorium nuclear clock. It is very briefly, a rather different system in the field. I'm speaking about a nuclear clock here. What I mean is just that we have the reference transition now derived not from an atomic electromagnetic system, but from a nuclear transition, from a gamma ray transition. And the motivation here is mainly threefold. One hopes on to get a higher precision out of this clock. As I mentioned, most of the dominant contributions to the uncertainty budget comes from field-induced shifts, and these will be smaller because of the smallness of the nuclear moment, so these can be reduced. The frequency of the nuclear transition may be higher than of the electronic transition. This may help in improving the frequency, the stability of the clock. As I've shown you, the stability scales with the frequency, with the reference frequency. So here we may work in the VUV or even X-ray transitions, but this is so far just projections towards the future, because we don't have any suitable sources of the narrowband coherent sources of the radiation as we have in the optical range. And also important, we can maybe improve the stability by working with much bigger ensembles of atoms or of nuclei. So in the ultra high vacuum systems that we work with single ions or with very low density laser cooled atomic gases, we have maybe single or 10^6 atoms. But here for a nuclear line, one may consider working in a solid state environment, or maybe investigating 10^10 particles in a Mössbauer like configuration, and then obtaining higher stability. The system of interest and of study is this thorium-229 nucleus. Here you can see the level structure, the nuclear level structure. It is dominated by rotational bands, and then it happens that the ground state is very close to a band head of another band. So this structure was very well understood, but there was no, the two bands had never appeared separately, and that was the start of the investigation to look for the energy, very small energy difference between these two levels. And the present state of the information is summarized here in this plot. So it is a magnetic dipole transition linking these two lines, and the energy inferred indirectly from gamma spectroscopy is the best value is 7.8 electron volt in the vacuum UV radiation, and, but the uncertainty of this is still about 0.5 electron volts, so we have like a 10%, 5 to 10% relative uncertainty in the transition energy, and that is of course the big experimental problem before making, before building a clock, we have to find the line. And
is there a laser to drive it?
Yes, there is. Oh. There is laser. So I will. There is technical means to drive. That's possible.
So it's 7.8 plus minus what for the
0.5 EV. And that's the estimate for the from the gamma spectroscopy. And now then. These two references here point out why it is, why it may be a good clock. I was saying hand-wavingly, okay, the nuclear moments are small, and so the shifts are from external fields are smaller. But if one looks more into detail, it's not as easy, because we planned not to work with a bare nucleus, but with an atomic system. So there's the electron shell around, there's hyperfine coupling, and one needs to take this into account. But the main advantage that one has here is that one can choose the electronic environment and search for a suitable electronic state in which this nuclear excitation is investigated. And this gives the extra degrees of freedom that allow to eliminate the field-induced shifts to a level that is not possible with electronic transitions. And this is explained here. And this was the underlying basic idea behind this this nuclear clock. Why is the nuclear clock superior, possibly, to atomic clocks as we know them today? And then there was the proposal by Victor Flambaum. We already discussed in 2008 here. He wrote this paper in Physische Flatter, pointing out that this transition frequency here actually may be the most sensitive probe for changes of variations of the coupling constants. And the simple argument that to understand this is that this very small energy difference of a few electron volt can only appear by an accidental cancellation of order mega electron volt contributions to the nuclear energy levels. And so that if the coupling constants change, then this perfect cancellation will very quickly be out of balance. And then one sees a strong sensitivity both to electromagnetic and strong interactions with a sensitivity factor maybe 10 to the 5. This paper then triggered immediately a discussion, quite controversial also, with different papers pointing out that actually it is not as simple, but it depends a lot on the nuclear structure. Some people said the sensitivity would basically be zero, and others said it would be 10 to the 5. But then there was a very nice analysis here, or the proposal that this can, for the alpha sensitivity, it can be resolved by combining measurements of the isomer shift and atomic structure calculations to determine the sensitivity factor independently. And so these measurements need to be done, and then we can also determine these factors experimentally. And so it's a very promising system, but yeah, the big experimental difficulties are still waiting to find the transition energy. So work is concentrating on these two different aspects of using either trapped ions or ions in as dopant in solids. There are several groups around the world now with trapped ions. It is also the group of Alex Kuzmich at in Georgia Tech. And then there is Eric Hudson's group working on the solid state approach, and also a group in Vienna, Thorsten Schum, working on the crystals. So different experimental approaches are tested here, and we hope to obtain a breakthrough in the near future to start this very interesting field. With a few more slides, maybe what are we planning to do, and how do we solve this problem of building a laser? We plan to use a so-called electronic bridge excitation. So this is something that has been considered in nuclear physics also for quite some time, that the electron shell may have an influence on gamma decay and excitation rates. And what in our case, so one can in under favorable conditions when there's a resonance between the nuclear transition and an electronic transition, the presence of the electron shell may strongly enhance the gamma transition rates of the nucleus. And we plan to make use of this. And there's two important advantages. So we can use it to drive the nuclear transition not as a single photon, but as a two-photon process. And it means that we don't need this very short wavelength laser. And the other aspect, yes, it may lead to a strongly enhanced rate if there is a resonance. And we hope that it is likely to have such a resonance in a dense level structure like in thorium plus. And we investigated this, so here's first the how the scheme would look like. So we would have, this is the electronic levels in the ground state and in the isomeric state. We would drive two photons, first on a resonant line of the electronic shell, then the second photon from a tunable laser would provide the energy that matches the nuclear excitation energy, and magnetic dipole hyperfine coupling would then excite the isomeric state. There may also be a process like this where an excited state in the shell is excited, and then via spontaneous photon energy is transferred to the nucleus. And Victor Flambaum, Sergei Porsev have actually done atomic structure calculations to point out how efficient this process is. Of course, the excitation rate here will be very strong if there's a direct resonance between the nuclear frequency and an electronic frequency. So each of these are electronic levels. But even if we are maximally pessimistic and saying the nuclear resonance is here in between some weaker electronic lines, we still have a good enhancement of the excitation rate, and this shall help us in searching for the line with laser excitation. And we have now prepared this experiment. We first by investigating the electronic level structure, which was not known in this energy range. So this is just a statistical counting the number of levels. About 500 levels of thorium plus are known, one of the richest spectra in atomic physics. But analysis stopped at about 5 to 6 EV, and now we have gone in this range of 7 to 8 EV. And yes, there is a considerable density of levels. So we hope that we have good enhancement of the bridge process. And now more recently, we have just started work with trapping the radioactive isotope. It is radioactive, so it is introduces some complications in the experiment, but we are now trapping it. We are doing laser spectroscopy of this line, strong resonance line here. We can see the hyperfine structure. And so we are now well prepared to do a search range using this electron bridge excitation. And we hope to do this search well during this year. So this is just an outlook on an open experimental project, but I think that is very promising for the also for tests and for the improvements of the clocks. So with this, I'd like to conclude by acknowledging my co-workers in the optical clocks group at PDB, people working on the ions, on the frequency measurements, on the cesium fountain, and. As a very last slide, or I have like an outlook or a list of topics that I find interesting for the discussion. We will discuss more, I think, during the open microphone sessions. Here, I was very pleased to looking at the program of this workshop that nearly all the subjects that I thought would be relevant in the field are actually part of the program already. We will have precise clocks in a variety of systems, and we will hear more about different systems today. And I think, as I mentioned, it's very important to have to look at different systems, to look at different kinds of new physics in order to interpret these experiments. We will hear about, by Michel Lukin, on entanglement, a very important factor for improving stability of clocks, combining clocks. We will hear about satellite missions and global navigation systems, which are maybe, of course, the most important application of clocks today, very powerful networks of clocks that is available. And also important, we will see portable clocks that allow non-local experiments by moving clocks for tests of relativity. A lot of discussion presently is in this field of relativistic geodesy, of using clocks measuring redshift in order to obtain the gravitational potential, not as a test of relativity, but rather as a method, as a sensor in geodesy. So these are very interesting new applications, new opportunities for tests, and I'm looking forward to discussing these with you during this workshop. Thank you very much.
So we will have a photo session just a few minutes after our questions.
Maybe it's a longer question, so we should postpone it for the open mic, but this is kind of turning the ion on its head, or turning the ion clock on its head. How sensitive can you be to background stray electromagnetic fields? In other words, can it be a great magnetometer? Can it be a great measurement of background electric fields for the ionic? Can you make an ionic system? Part of the motivation was, Maxime was talking about, thinking generally about new light fields, but it doesn't just have to be scalars. We've been thinking a lot about vectors, and those often appear like new stray fields.
So I'd say a new external field carries some, I don't know, angle momentum numbers, right? And we can facilitate an optical transition to the ground state.
Yeah. Okay, it's good. It's quite a wide field, yes. So we are, of course, very sensitive to low-frequency electromagnetic fields, simply because they will displace or accelerate the ion. So we can really cool down the ion to the, not quantum logic experiments, can cool down the ion to the quantum ground state, and then one can look how are they heated or accelerated out of this ground state. This actually is a big experimental issue or a big experimental problem, because we want to rather prevent this, and this is very sensitive to fluctuating fields.
What does low frequency mean?
Low frequency means in the kilohertz to megahertz range. So let's see, that's the mechanical resonances of the trapped ion. For magnetic fields, I would say there's not much advantage of the ion trapping technique. The magnetic coupling, the Zeeman coupling, is really always the linear quadratic Zeeman effect with the usual atomic parameters. Of course, we have a very nice perturbation-free environment, in the sense that we can work at ultra-high vacuum. I think one could expect very long coherence times. There have been hyperfine coherences measured over minutes or hours, maybe, or so. But with neutral atoms, this can also be done in a cell, and one can get even longer times, but then at much higher atom numbers. So there, I think the ion does not offer specific advantages.
But do you know what size electric fields? Well, I can bug you more about this later.
Oh, so I was going to ask. Could you use the just the MOSFET transitions directly and monitor? And is there a scheme by which you could, without having a nuclear clock, is there some way to look at MOSFET transitions as a probe of physics that you can't get with optical atomic transitions, and look for stability and transients and things like that? The MOSFET transition somehow?
Well, I think really remarkable things have been done with MOSFET transitions, and actually a lot of what I'm trying to learn from about nuclear physics now, I'm looking at papers on MOSFET spectroscopy from the 60s or so, and all these great tests about relativity that have been done. The first thing that we could do here would be to enhance MOSFET type of experiments by making use of the coherent source that we have, that we don't have to rely just on a source made with spontaneous emission and then tuning via the Doppler effect, which also became very difficult finally for the with just micrometer per second or so the movement for the linear Doppler effect. So I think we will have very sensitive MOSFET experiments using laser excitation. The other way around, what kind of standard MOSFET experiments? I've not thought about it. What they can do in terms of other looking at other tests. I guess it would be worthwhile to look at this. The Mössbauer spectroscopy, I showed these very nice narrow lines. Today, Mössbauer spectroscopy still holds the world record in spectroscopic resolution. I think it's also in the 10 to the minus 15 range. The optical spectra are getting close, but these very narrow lines in Mössbauer are available. And yes, it may be an interesting system to look at, but I have no specific idea presently.
It's a related question. I understand when you talk about the nuclear flows that now you most have in mind no longer atoms trapped on single atom, single particle, but in a crystal.
No, we are looking, I think one looks at both.
What do you say is the more promising part, and are you worried about perturbation by the crystal?
This is actually strongly related to these qualities of clocks that I introduced in the beginning. So we believe that for the highest accuracy, the trapped ions will be the best system. So this is a system that can be laser cooled. It will be in an ion trap. We were very excited about this because it means we can apply all the techniques that we are using for the atomic single ion clocks, but just use it here, apply it to a nuclear transition. So that would be the highest accuracy. The solid state, of course, promises a much higher stability. But as you mentioned, one needs to worry about the systematics. It will very critically depend on the crystal host. That there will be there may be field gradients, and then if the lattice moves, if there is phonon interactions, then these very fluctuating fields will shift the line. So probably in order to also reach low accuracy, one probably also needs to work with solid state, but at cryogenic temperature, where the phonon influences are really frozen out.
Very good. If there are no further questions, let's postpone any further discussion for the rest of the day. And we thank the speaker as well.